The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Yep, okay. Welcome. I'm Helene Gale, the co-chair of this conference and president of the International AIDS Society. I'd like to welcome all of you here for this session on the plenary this morning on prevention. If 10 years ago in Vancouver that the conference was really the advent of heart, and in many ways one could say the treatment conference, in many ways I think this conference is becoming the prevention conference. The themes of prevention are really being heard strongly throughout. And as all of you heard in the opening speeches of Bill and Melinda Gates, the need for prevention, both access to existing technologies as well as expanding options, was a real theme of their speeches. And you've been hearing in many other sessions about the urgent need to intensify prevention efforts worldwide. We all know that the harsh reality that is that we're quickly falling behind in HIV prevention. Last year, more than 4 million people became infected with HIV. So it's clear that unless we dramatically scale up the efforts in prevention and reduce the rate of new infection, there's simply no hope of bringing this epidemic under control. In addition, as was pointed out by several speakers, without intensifying prevention, there is no hope of sustaining the important progress that we're making today on treatment. For every person currently receiving treatment, about 4 people became infected in the last year alone. So we must urgently accelerate access to prevention tools that we know are already available, and several speakers spoke of them in presentations today, things like behavior change, information, condoms, clean needles, testing, et cetera. But these tools aren't being used. Fewer than 1 in 5 people at high risk of HIV have access to the things that we already know work and have available today. In addition, we must accelerate the development of a new generation of prevention approaches and assure that once they're available and we know that they're effective, that we do all within our power to make them accessible to those who need them the most as soon as possible. Now, the speakers in today's plenary session addressed a range of critical issues in HIV prevention, and we'll hear from each of them in a moment. I wanted to just say a word about a report that I hope all of you will have here on your seat, and that's the most recent report from the Global HIV Prevention Working Group. It's a new report on prevention research. The working group is a group that I co-chair along with David Sawada from Makerere University in Uganda, international panel of 50 top AIDS experts who have expertise in prevention. And the purpose of this report is to draw attention to the potential new breakthroughs on the horizon in prevention research. They're the very things that Geeta Ramji talked about in her presentation this morning. Some of these approaches may be effective within the next few years, things like male circumcision, diaphragms, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. However, there are major hurdles facing new prevention approaches, and this new report talks about what some of the challenges are, some of the obstacles in conducting clinical prevention trials, and as I said, highlights the urgent need to make sure that these new approaches will be accessible to all who need them as soon as they're proven effective. So we hope that you'll take a copy of this and look at these as well. Now let me just introduce our plenary speakers. First, to my right is Cristina Pimenta. In her remarks today, Dr. Cristina Pimenta of Brazil, from the Brazil International AIDS Association, discussed the need for HIV prevention programs that respond to the underlying social factors that contribute to increased risk of HIV infection. Dr. Geeta Ramji of South Africa spoke to the potential benefit of the current research on biomedical interventions, including microbicides. Dr. Francois Barra-Sinoussi of France, of the Institut Pasteur, highlighted the urgent need for the more fundamental research and creative research to fill gaps, scientific gaps in HIV Vaccine Research, and Dr. Alex Wodak from Australia, the St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, examine the status of global efforts to control HIV among injecting drug users through the use of harm reduction programs. So I will turn it over to our panelists to give a few comments.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. Well, my presentation, I tried to highlight the aspects related to social vulnerability and how it affects or creates barriers and increases the risk to HIV infection of most of the affected regions of the country. The thing is that we cannot just look at individual behavior. We have to look at individual risk behavior together with the social and structural aspects that and the context, social context where the population is living in. And today we see that a lot of issues related to poverty, violence, and lack of alternatives to youth are strong issues that do increase people's vulnerability to HIV. On the other hand, issues related to human rights and gender power inequality are also still main issues that we need to work through information, especially education of both boys and girls, so that we have more equitable relationships as adults when they start their sexual relations. Another issue that I would point out is that we do have political, not just material barriers to access prevention, but we also have political barriers to access prevention. And even though governments and donor agencies are aware of the effective prevention, scientifically proven effective prevention measures we have available for to prevent, only 9% of the most at-risk populations in the world have access to prevention. And less than 50% of all youth in the world have access to actual knowledge on HIV/AIDS and access to prevention measures. So we still have a lot to do and a lot to go for. And if we want to aim at universal access to prevention as well as treatment by 2010 and 2015, we have to move now. We have to base our approaches in human rights issues and really make prevention methods and programs accessible in our for our populations.
Thank you. Ita.
Thank you. Well, the purpose of my presentation was basically to tell you more about the new prevention technologies. Can you not hear me? It's fine. Just the purpose of my presentation was to tell the you and the world about the new prevention technologies, where we are, what are the theoretical basis of these new prevention technologies, as well as when do we expect the results of these technologies. And in my presentation, I wanted to highlight the positive and the hope that we have in terms of prevention. And we have, as you have heard, that the several prevention technologies, the results will be out soon, maybe late 2007, early 2008. But more importantly, I think it's for people to realize that we are going beyond the ABC of prevention. And as you all know, that I have described a new acronym that goes right up to I. And that I means that more than ABC, we have an additional C for circumcision, D for diaphragm for HIV prevention, E for exposure prophylaxis, both pre and post, F for female controlled microbicides, G for genital tract infections, H for HSV2 suppressive therapy, and I for immunization through vaccine. And we have to believe that we are getting to I, from ABC right up to I. But all these advances in clinical trial do not come without further challenges. And that's all research is about, is that you overcome one hurdle and you have other challenges that you have to face. But I strongly believe that these challenges can be overcome with cohesive response from the scientists and the donors and the sponsors of clinical trials. I also would like to do that. I would like to mention the fact that when we do these large-scale phase three clinical trials at the ground level and at the scientific level, there are huge challenges. For example, getting the appropriate sample size for testing. And as you saw from the presentation I have made this morning, that majority of the infections are not even in the West and East Africa, but more so in Southern Africa. And it means that more and more trial sites need to be developed in areas where the infection rate is high enough to measure the efficacy of these products. So incidence remains very, very important in order to assess whether these technologies are going to be effective or not. And as with scientific data, every scientific trial that's going to have results soon will have to have another trial done in order to ensure that that we have an efficacious product. For example, these current trials are not going to be the definitive answers. We're going to have new trials. And in order to do new trials, we're going to have new trial sites. And in order to have new trial sites, we have to build capacity. So there's a lot of work to be done. It's nice to know that we're going to have answers to soon, but we also need to be cognizant of the fact that there are challenges, not only in clinical trial capacity, but also in the issue of care. We are screening out large number of HIV-positive people. What is our standard of care going to be? What do we do with people who seroconvert in clinical trials? How are we going to deal with that? And a lot of us who work on the ground have developed strategies, but these are not universal strategies. I firmly believe these strategies have to be in the country, with working with service providers and the government in the country to develop strategies of care. In addition to that, the issue of informed consent has to be dealt with on as an ethical issue.
Thank you. Thank you. Just to keep them short so we have time for the questions. And I just want to also note that Nancy Padian, who is one of the researchers doing work on female diaphragm, is with us. She wasn't on the plenary, so she's not part of this panel, but she would be, I'm sure, happy to take questions as well. Very involved in this sort of research and finding new tools. Françoise.
Yes, well, shortly, as Hélène said, I tried to highlight during my talk the major gaps for progressing, accelerating vaccine research. So the purpose of my talk is to try to remember people that very often everyone is looking for a vaccine, but we don't know yet whether a preventive prophylactic vaccine is possible or not. We don't know, and we will not know if we don't push, accelerate basic science. Up to now, a lot of approach has been tried. It's what I say, the more of the same approach, which are the quite empirical approach, traditional approach. We need to be more creative for tomorrow, and to be more creative for tomorrow, we need to fill the gaps, the scientific gaps, and we will fill the scientific gaps only if we make basic science in immunology, particularly, and in HIV/AIDS pathogenesis. The hopes that I highlight in my talk is that we are making fantastic progress during the last years or so in basic science, in knowledge of HIV pathogenesis, and also in immunology. So I still believe that in this century, we will have at least first the answer whether a prophylactic vaccine is possible or not. And if it is possible, we should be able to develop it and to deliver it. Secondly, if it's not possible, we should think about other alternatives. And in particular, I mentioned the hope with vaccine therapy.
Thank you. Alex. You want to just hand it? yours, Francoise. Do you want to speak?
Okay, now it's on. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My presentation was about harm reduction, and that's to say it was about the ways in which we can control HIV among injecting drug users and from injecting drug users to the general population. Injecting drug use now accounts for about 1 in every 10 new HIV infections around the world, and that means it's responsible for about 30% of new HIV infections occurring outside Africa. And the proportion of global HIV infections attributable to injecting drug use is growing. Drug use around the world is also a growing problem that the war on drugs approach has completely failed to arrest. And it's now estimated by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime to be an industry with an annual turnover of $322 billion a year, which means that it accounts for 8% of total international trade. And a recent report to the Blair Cabinet in the United Kingdom estimated that 26 to 58% of that turnover is made up of profit. So it's this is what's fueling the epidemic of HIV among injecting drug users worldwide, and we're now seeing injecting drug use spreading into Africa. On the other hand, we are very able to control HIV infections among injecting drug users, and we've known how to do that for at least 15 years. It's probably one of the most effective interventions in the entire HIV/AIDS spectrum of interventions. The toolkit's fairly simple. We need to educate drug users. That's not difficult. We need to provide needle syringe programs so that sterile injecting equipment is readily available and is used. And we need to get dirty equipment that's been used out of circulation. That's not difficult to arrange. We need to provide effective and attractive drug treatment. For heroin users, we have quite good drug treatments, not so good for stimulant users, amphetamine and cocaine users. But drug treatment has to be diverse. It has to be a range of options, and we know how to do that. Finally, we need to involve the drug users in these activities, not just as passive recipients, but as active participants designing the programs. The major barrier we have to getting this to happen has been the excessive reliance on drug law enforcement. And we face a battle all over the world, but particularly in those parts of the world where we need harm reduction most urgently, and that's in Central and Eastern Europe and Central Asia, where the epidemic among injecting drug users is of alarming proportions. We also have some problems with bits of the UN system, although most of the UN system is now very supportive of these pragmatic public health type approaches, and the International Narcotics Control Board is the single part major obstacle within the UN system and parts of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Of course, in terms of national opposition to harm reduction, the most important country is the United States, which has the highest incidence of AIDS, annual AIDS in the world, roughly in the industrialized world, roughly 5 times higher than the second highest country in the industrialized world, which is Spain. And the United States has got this unenviable record, at least in part because of the failure to control HIV among injecting drug users in the United States. Yet the opposition by the United States prevents these pragmatic approaches being spread throughout the world. However, there's been a huge change in attitudes around the world in the last 5 years with major movements towards harm reduction in most of the populous countries in Asia, which is very important because that's where half the world's population lives and that's where a lot of injecting drug users live. So we're making progress, but the sad truth is that HIV is still spreading faster among injecting drug users than the harm reduction programs that we need to prevent them. And I find it particularly galling and tragic in that this is one part of the epidemic we really could do something about, and yet it's the politics that in so many countries prevents us doing what has to be done. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll begin the questions. I also just want to acknowledge Jen Cates from the Kaiser Family Foundation, who, along with the Gates Foundation, is a co-convener of the Global HIV Prevention Working Group, the report that I mentioned that highlights the opportunities, challenges that Geeta so nicely laid out in her presentation. So just wanted to acknowledge Jen as well in the work of the Kaiser Family Foundation. So why don't we take questions? Steve, first question. And if everybody will stand and say who they are and who they represent.
Steve Sternberg, USA Today.
And their zodiac sign. No.
Dr. Wodak, could you repeat the numbers you offered about... Let me go back and see what I've missed here. Just the growth in the drug industry around the world and the profit figures.
The annual turnover was $322 billion US a year, and that's the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime estimate. And the extent to which that's accounted for by profit taking is 26% to 58%. And the source document for that is a document that was produced by the Strategy Unit, as it's so called, that was directed by Lord Burt, ex-director general of the BBC, and that was commissioned by the Blair cabinet, and it was a confidential document which was leaked by a patriotic civil servant to The Guardian and supplied to the world through that source.
And the acoustics aren't great, so really speak up if you can. Yeah.
Yeah, hello, it's Martin Flynn from Positive Nation. Dr. Pimenta, you suggested that we might have some sort of treatment by end of this year or early next year to prevent transmission. Could you amplify on that, please?
Wasn't me. It was...
You're saying they add... When do we expect to have some of these new prevention technologies that are in trials now? Okay.
Okay. Well, the results are going to be, the trials will be completed. Well, they're different technologies. So microbicides, for example, the first results will be out end of 2000. But you must remember that once the results are out there, we need to license and mass produce and look at all the licensor issues. So we're hoping that the first product will be available if found to be efficacious around 2010.
Yes. And just to, for people who are interested in the dates of these trials and when the expected results are, in this report, there's a chart that summarizes all of these trials and expected dates when results would be available, so that there's a good overview of that. Yes.
Rita Daly from the Toronto Star. This report says that there's been a lack of communication that has slowed and even stopped some of these prevention trials. Could somebody elaborate on that?
A lack of communication that has stalled, slowed, yes, okay.
Well, as you know, that any trial that has been conducted in any country has to have approval from various organizations. That means the ethical approval as well as regulatory approval. But more importantly, it's important to communicate to the community in which the research is being done exactly what the basis of the research is and have ongoing communication with the community to give them update and on how the trials are ongoing. So I think in some trials where the trial had to be stopped, the issue was lack of communication, where the community felt that their discussion wasn't transparent enough for them to understand what was happening in clinical trials. But yeah. That was just one particular area. But in majority of the trials that are ongoing in many of the centers around Africa, there has been community involvement, community advisory board set up. So there is an ongoing consultation with the community.
Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn Chase from the Wall Street Journal. I would just like to confirm a couple of dates that were gone over extremely quickly by a couple of the presenters, and I'm not sure whether I didn't hear correctly. First of all, Dr. Barré-Sinoussi, you mentioned when you were talking about prospects for a preventive vaccine, you said that we would have the answer by the end of this century. Did you mean century or decade?
I was meaning century. Okay, because
by 2100,
we cannot give any dates today. Okay, concerning the development of preventive prophylactic vaccine.
Okay.
But I think the point was that because we can't predict it, we know that it is possible. We know we will have one. We just can't say, you know, we've stopped predicting anymore whether it's 5 years, whether it's 10 years, whether it's 15. We are fully confident that we will have a vaccine. I think that, in a way,
I will not be as confident as Hélène is concerning prophylactic vaccine. I believe more myself about the vaccine that will prevent the development of the disease.
But that we will have one.
We will have one.
As opposed to
when
focus
we
on the date.
Say.
And there was another date that I perhaps misheard by Dr. Ramji when she just mentioned that if the microbicide products will be out by 2010, you said the data on the first trials will be completed by 2000. Did you mean
2007? The first trial will be completed by mid 2007, and we're hoping to have data by end of 2007.
And if we could get your slide of products, that would be great, blown up, because it's not visible on the printout.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right there.
Thank you. David Johnson, Waverley Care in Scotland. Dr. Ramji, can you give us any data about developments of microbicides which will work for anal sex?
Well, there has been a lot of preclinical and phase one type of trials where we're hoping that the products will be tested in humans for HIV prevention through anal sex. But it's very, very early at this point in time, so we do not have accurate data on exactly what happens and how the product is going to be used for anal sex. But we're a long way away in developing a rectal microbicide.
Mark van Brivane from Antwerp, Belgium. Bill Clinton told us that Bill Gates can predict the future. Bill Gates said that pre-exposure prophylaxis will be a major breakthrough. What's your opinion on pre-exposure prophylaxis? What's the place of it in a mix of prevention tools?
Do you want to answer? I can't speak on Bill Gates's future predicting abilities, but I think there is a fair amount of enthusiasm and good biologic plausibility for why pre-exposure prophylaxis should work. That's not without its challenges, but there's good reason biologically, good evidence that these pre-exposure prophylaxis pre-exposure prophylaxis as an approach could very well be a real breakthrough in prevention. So yes, we believe that this is something that could in a few short years prove to be an effective prevention strategy. That being said, I think with all of these prevention strategies that we're talking about, these expanded new approaches, none of them do we expect will be 100% effective. So I think a very important point that Dr. Ramji made in her presentation is that we shouldn't be thinking about these as magic bullets, as silver bullets, but as things that will, in combination with behavioral prevention and all the other things that we know make a difference, will really expand our options. So we believe that this is an option that will be very likely effective, and we look forward to the completion of trials.
Ida, U.S., the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Dr. Barré-Sinoussi, I'd like to know, because since you're involved in basic empirical science, if you could give us a way in which to explain to our audiences what it is about the HIV virus that makes developing a vaccine so difficult. And the goalposts have been shifted. We appreciate that there are reasons for that, but how do we explain it to audiences? And Dr. Ramji, if I could just ask you to please say what the response has been to male partners of the people already involved in the trials to the microbicide. Thanks.
Okay, there are several obstacles, barriers for developing a vaccine against HIV. Of course, very often people are mentioning the diversity of the virus. It's an obstacle, it's a barrier, but it's not the only one. And we should not think that we have only one barrier to solve. We know that the virus is also capable to infect the cells that are supposed to respond against the infection. And not only it infects the cells, but it can also alter the function of the cell even if they are not infected. Thirdly, I will say that we have to remember that this virus can be transmitted from cells to cell, not only as free virus as very often we think about. So that means that the vaccine should block the infection from one cell to another cell, the transmission cell to cell. So the fact that the virus also can enter the cells and stay into the host genome, and you cannot see it, it's also a problem. It can get a persistent infection that the immune system will not see. Okay. So this is more or less all the obstacles that we have to solve. They are not the only one. We are limited also by the animal model for testing, evaluating as a preclinical trials vaccine. And I will say that we are limited also by our knowledge on the mechanism by which vaccine protect outside of the HIV field. Okay. We don't really know today, and we don't care, because you have a vaccine protect, you are happy. Okay. You don't care what are the mechanisms. But for HIV, it would be nice to know how vaccines that work are working, because it will help to try to stimulate maybe some new response in the future.
Okay, when we enter the community, we educate men as well. But for study participants, those women who have divulged their participation to their male partners, we invite the male partners to learn more about microbicides. And I personally have interviewed male partners of women who have informed their partners about their involvement. And it's been very encouraging to know that male partners are very supportive of women's use of microbicides. But they also stress that microbicides or the gel that the partner is using makes the sex more pleasurable. So that's a big plus.
Put a question right there, and then you... Can't hear.
I'm Apoorva Mandavilli from Nature Medicine. There was a lot of duplication with the HIV vaccine trials, and the same thing seems to be happening now with the PrEP trials. Tenofovir is being tested in several different trials, and I'm wondering if there's any discussion on how to avoid that and which drugs, if any, will be tested soon.
Yeah. I think you raise a good point, and both Francoise and Gita mentioned in their discussions about some of the coordination mechanisms that are being put in place so that the same sort of duplication and perhaps unnecessary duplication doesn't occur in the different prevention fields, like the microbicide development strategy that's particularly focused on microbicides, the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise, looking at better coordination of research and a more strategic approach to research. But I think in the pre-exposure prophylaxis trials, as you mentioned, part of the reason why so many trials are being done is that the necessity to have enough participants enrolled to be able to actually test for efficacy. So those trials are being done in coordination. There's a lot of discussion among the researchers, but the trials are being done so that there is enough power to detect whether or not there there is a difference and be able to talk about, be able to get results about efficacy.
Larry Altman, New York Times. Can you give specific examples, I mean, concrete examples of where trials were stopped because of miscommunications in the community? And secondly, specific examples that are cited in the report about the need for new ethical guidelines. You're making broad platitudes, but it weakens the report unless you give specific examples. So can you provide us some?
Well, as an example, the trial in Cameroon, the tenofovir trial in Cameroon, was stopped because there was considerable concern from the community and also from the government about whether or not they had been sufficiently involved in the early phases of the trial and whether they understood the trial, what the benefits were, and had any had enough input into the study design. So that's one example. I think when we talk about the ethical considerations, there's a whole range of issues, but I think one of the issues that comes up most strongly, and Geeta mentioned this several times in her presentation and comments, is what's the ethics of the trial, the responsibility to treat. It becomes a very, very major issue that we think about a lot about treating the people who are in the trials who become positive as a result of, or during, not as a result of, during participation in the trial. It's inevitable people who are in trials because they are at particular risk. So some of them will get infected. And I think most people do feel strongly that there's an obligation to treat people who are enrolled in trials. But I think where it gets more difficult is what about the people who you screen and screen out because they're HIV positive and therefore are not eligible for trials? What's our obligation to treat those people who aren't participants? What's our obligation to treat the communities from which we're doing the trials in? And so I think there are issues like this that become very complicated and also become limited by resource constraints. So I think those are the kinds of practical things that we think about when we look at what are the ethics, what are we sure that we're meeting ethical, the best ethical standards in terms of providing all that we know makes a difference for prevention. It's going to become very difficult once one of these prevention options becomes, once we find that it's efficacious, are we then obligated to include that in any ongoing trials as well, which then makes the trial more difficult to do. So these issues, as you get further and further, there are these very complex ethical issues that need to be addressed if we feel that that we're living up to the highest ethical standards. And I don't know if anybody else wants to add anything to that.
No, I think it's absolutely necessary that as we advanced into current clinical trials where we see incidence rate, but once we find another additional prevention intervention, what will be the new ethical guidelines? Do we include that as part of the standard of care package?
Yes, back there, sorry. And sorry, and just one other point that I think on the issue of ethics that I think is also important to point out is the informed consent, which continues to be an issue of how best to make sure that people who are in trials understand fully and feel that they had full informed consent, and how well are we doing in that? Because I think that, again, becomes an issue that is often raised in the conduct of communities that may not have had as much experience with research trials.
Jan Hablans, Dutch National Radio. I note that not any more testing is on the list of preventive interventions, and it has been used as well, there was a lot of advocacy for testing because it would change people's behavior. What is the status at the moment? That's my one question, if you allow me a second question to Alec Wodak, and that is he happy with the intermittent goals that are formulated for the Millennium Goals for 2010 if we're talking about intravenous drug users?
Thank you. And the first question was about testing. You included that in yours. You saying why don't we include testing as a prevention strategy? You may just mentioned.
I think what I was trying to say to that as a prevention strategy, the more people that know their status, their HIV tested will become more and more important. So we need to scale up VCT in these prevention trials and the prevention communities as well.
Regarding the question about the Millennium Development Goals, it's very important that Millennium Goal number 6 is about HIV control, and that's in at least one country been critical, in Malaysia's case, been critical for that country adopting harm reduction. Setting these goals and targets at a very high level in the international community does have an impact. In the drugs area, there's an important meeting coming up in 2008, perhaps 2009, which will be a review of the extent to which we've become a drug-free world since 1998. And the way that conference will play out will have an impact on the way harm reduction gets implemented. Can I also mention that in the speech I referred, that I, in the plenary session, I referred to a declaration of unity that calls for unity within the UN organisation so that they start to speak with one voice. And I have a number of colleagues who are here in this room now who are able to, from different parts of the world, who are available to people in this room to speak to them. They're sitting in the back row there. Maybe they could put their hands up. And there are some people there from Central and Eastern Europe, Bijan from Iran, a number of other countries and other regions of the world represented. And if you wish to speak to them about how this, how harm reduction is playing out in their parts of the world, and also about this declaration of unity and what that adds to the scene, I'm sure they'd be happy to discuss that with you.
Over here.
Fran Lowry, Internal Medicine News. Dr. Ramji, you mentioned male circumcision as one preventive measure. How do you convince men to go into your studies of male circumcision, and how effective is male circumcision in prevention?
Well, I wasn't part of the male circumcision study, although it was conducted in South Africa, but I think it involved a lot of education and taking of the informed consent, whether the men would understand what it means, and giving them some background information on the epidemiological data on what previous observational studies have shown. So it involves a lot of education, and if people perceive themselves at risk, they would come forward for participation.
Yeah, and just to add, in all the trials, the circumcision trials that are ongoing, there was a fair amount of upfront acceptability work, as Geeta mentioned, and there was a high level of acceptability, and there's been a high level of interest and participation. Last question. Sorry.
Thank you. Just a quick question for Dr. Geeta. Why the new generation of new female condoms were not mentioned as new technologies? And it's important to consider that female condoms are female-controlled methods available, and we can prove they are efficient and their efficacy.
I do not doubt that female condoms are extremely important. But the focus of my talk was new prevention technologies for HIV prevention. And given that there are no current trials on HIV prevention using new female condoms, I decided to exclude that. And I informed my partners doing female condom studies that I do apologize for that. But unfortunately, I could not include it because I was looking at current clinical trials for HIV prevention.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Pimenta had one final comment you wanted to make. Yep.
Just something that I pointed out in my presentation is that with all these advances in prevention technologies, we have to be careful not to go for the medicalization of prevention, because even with these technologies, we're talking about people and we're talking about behavior and attitudes. And on the other hand, even if we have pre-exposure prophylaxis being proven, we don't even have enough medication for treatment of people that are living with HIV/AIDS today. So I don't think we would have enough for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And side effects of treatment are very, it's a very difficult treatment to go with. So it's not, I would like, since you're media people, not to put out on the media that these are magical solutions for prevention, please.
Thank you. Thanks for your participation.
It's a pleasure.